Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you to our last scheduled oral arguments for not only the month of December, but the year 2015. Our first case is 12 AP 1869, Richard S. Wilcox versus Estate of Ralph Hines. And arguing on behalf of the estate of Hines and Newman and Lake Delton Holdings is counsel James E. Bartson. You have 25 minutes. Mr. Corcoran, Attorney Corcoran has 30, and Mr. Bartson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. 36 years after I was introduced to the concept of adverse possession by Professor Krubeck, I have the privilege of addressing the Supreme Court and presenting an adverse possession argument.
Did you save your notes, counsel?
If I did, Your Honor, they're in an apartment somewhere in Milwaukee or somewhere behind a wall. I regret to say I did not. What I did save is some memory of what I learned. We learned that to prove adverse possession, the use of the land must be open, notorious, visible, exclusive, hostile, and continuous.
Okay.
And in Burkhart against Smith, a case which, as the court knows, I am relying on extensively, this court said that if the elements of open, notorious, continuous, and exclusive possession are satisfied, hostility is presumed. This case is about, obviously, claim of title and hostility.
Yeah, the other aspects are okay, aren't they? I mean, it was open, it was notorious, they were...
Continuous? Yes. Yes, they are.
It showed that the whole area was being maintained, right?
Yes. If
so
I was...
The only issue was hostile.
Yes.
Okay.
And let me rephrase it just a little bit different. Okay. The only issue is occupation under claim of title exclusive of any other right.
Right.
Which I think equates to hostility.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously we have to go by the statute.
But it means that you are claiming the property as yours against someone else who has record title or other title.
Precisely.
Okay.
Precisely. The problem here, in my view, is that the Court of Appeals blue-penciled the word presumed and replaced it with established and limited the evidence that the circuit court might consider in judging the character of the occupation. And I use that phrase because that's what this court used, judging the character of the occupation. It isn't possession alone that determines adverse possession. It can't be because there are other elements in the statute. So the circuit court's task is to judge the character of the occupation. And it does that by evidence. And this court, over 100 or 150 years, has refined the sorts of evidence that the circuit court can consider. But I believe, I respectfully submit, that the Court of Appeals inappropriately tightened up that evidence and that the evidence in this case actually would allow a circuit court to find that the Soma's occupation was not hostile, was not under claim of title exclusive of any other right.
Well, to get more to the point, I think, your argument is it was hostile to everyone but the true owners, or to everyone except who they thought were the true owners, which was the Wisconsin Ducks. And because they didn't exclude the correct owners, that their claim was not hostile to the individuals, to the estates of Hines and Newman, who turned out to be the true owners. And that's where we focus in. That's where the focus comes in. On the underclaim of title or hostility.
Yes.
Okay.
In other words, and I want to be clear that I have set aside the current owners, the Wilcoxes, and focused only on the Somas, the predecessors.
Why?
Because the Wilcoxes only owned for 10 years.
Well, but tacking is allowed.
Right, tacking is allowed, but you have to judge the character of the occupation of the person on whom you're going to tack.
Sure.
So I've only looked at the Somas.
When Somas bought the property, I understand, in 1963, I believe. Everyone operated under the assumption from 63, perhaps up until the present day, that the title owner of the property where the house is is free to have foot traffic over the disputed 25-foot strip. What is the instrument or document that gave to the Somas and then transferred from Somas to Wilcoxes the right of foot traffic over the 25-foot strip?
It was a land contract first and then a deed in 1963 from the predecessor in title that describes the property in meets and bounds at that time and states specifically, I could almost quote the language word for word, provided, however, the buyer has a right of foot traffic over the property to reach the lake.
And that easement, that's in the record?
Yeah, okay. That is in the record.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Bartson?
Yes.
I start with the idea, and I said this to my colleagues back in conference this morning, it ought to be hard. It ought to be tough to take someone else's property. I mean, there are ways to do that in the law where you do it by deed, you do it by transfer, you purchase it, and it's knowing. When you have adverse possession, that's sort of an exception to the rule of how property is transferred. So what is the legal standard that the trial court should have used? What is the burden to prove that? And what is the legal standard that the appellate courts ought to use in analyzing this?
Thank you. The legal standard that the trial court should apply is that each of the elements identified in the statute must be proved by clear and positive evidence. I've always read that as a clear and convincing evidence standard, although I think there is one case that said maybe it's really just a preponderance. That's the trial court. For the Court of Appeals, it is the standard that findings of fact are to be are not to be disturbed unless contrary to the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. Whether or not a particular fact fits a rule of law is reviewed by a court of appeals, an appellate court, de novo.
So where did the court of appeals miss the boat?
By taking facts and excluding them from what the circuit court could properly consider. I want to, if I might just address the standard of review, because I think that's important. In Burkhart, which was a case, an appeal, about judging the character of the occupation, this court used the great weight and clear preponderance standard, the standard of review that defers to the trial court's findings. I think these are findings of fact. Where the Court of Appeals missed the boat, I think, is in legally, de novo, shortening up or tightening what the circuit court ought to be able to consider. That's how I would view it. But let me address that point in one particular where I think the Court of Appeals improperly found facts. Wirtz against Fleischman, the classic case, says the Court of Appeals does not find facts. The evidence was that in 1982, the Ducks, the company that ran the duck boat tours on Lake Delton, came in with their bobcat onto this 25-foot strip, tore out vegetation, moved the land around, put rocks along the lake. I say that evidence, and Soma testified, no, I didn't object to that. I didn't go down and say, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing on this property? You know, where do you get off bringing a bobcat in and tearing it up? I didn't because I thought they owned it. So those facts you cannot make consistent with the phrase under claim of title exclusive of any other right. If Soma occupies is under claim of title exclusive of any other right. What are the ducks doing there with their bobcat without getting his permission? The Court of Appeals dealt with that, recognized that it is inconsistent with the idea of occupation under claim of title exclusive of any other right, but said, wait a minute, that was 1982, 20 years went by, so it doesn't matter anymore. That, I think, is where they really missed the standard of review, because they can't find facts, and they can't say the day after the ducks departed, the character of the occupation morphed from not adverse to adverse. That's a finding of fact that you have to defer to this. You have to affirm the circuit court unless its finding of fact was completely unsupportable by the evidence. So,
could I ask counsel, did the Somas have an easement on that strip?
Yes.
And the Wilcox have an easement on that strip?
Yes.
And what's the evidence of that easement?
It's in the record. It's the deed. The easement is granted in the deed that transferred the property from the predecessor in interest to Somas.
Who's granted the easement?
Grantor of that deed.
It sounds like it's an incestuous easement.
I believe it's Titus, but let me...
And who's Titus?
A former owner.
And who does Hines take from?
Hines is the transferor to
Soma?
Soma.
Okay, thanks.
Right, of the Soma property. This property started out being owned by Newman. Newman transferred part to Titus, retained part himself. Ultimately, the property 25 feet away from the lake was transferred to Soma. Those transfers reserved a right to cross the 25-foot strip to access the lake. And I'm glad that was brought up because it's important. A lot of our brief talked about permissive use. So...
Well, there's a difference between an easement and adverse possession.
Certainly.
If everyone who had an easement could have that become adverse possession, this would be a different world as far as real estate
right.
works. So that goes back to my original point.
They went further in maintaining this property than the easement, didn't they?
Yes, in part, though, because this was an argument raised by the Wilcoxes in their brief. So, and I want to be candid with the court that it's raised by me for the first time in my reply brief. So to the extent I'm overstepping my bounds, I would ask that the court tell me that. But the argument was raised that the Somas put a pier out into Lake Delton, abutting this 25-foot strip. Mr. Soma testified that he had permission to put the pier out. He asked John Dixon, the manager of the Ducks, whom he thought to be the owner of the property. The Wilcoxes argue that the right to put out the pier is derived from the grant of the easement to cross the lake to cross the strip to access the lake. That's in the Wilcoxes' brief, and we've responded to it in our reply brief. If that's the case, their presence on this strip of land and some of their use and occupation is without question permissive. It derives from their easement. So you have the circuit court was guided. The circuit court made findings of fact that the Somas did not occupy under claim of title exclusive of any other right because, in part, they asked for permission to use this. The Wilcox argument about the pier sort of establishes that this use is in part permissive.
Counsel, would you remind me, I'm not recalling, what year was the pier put in and the permission?
It was either 1963 or 1964.
So is there anything in the record that since 82 the Ducks either or their representatives came onto the property of the disputed 25-foot strip or did anything to exercise any kind of ownership and were not excluded by either Soma Ramos or Wilcox?
Nothing.
I'm not sure I understood. Let me ask the question a little bit differently, because I didn't quite understand that. The ducks, what is the relationship between the ducks and, say, the estate of Ralph Hines or the estate of William J. Newman?
To start from the beginning, and I want to be careful about what's in the record and what's not in the record, what could be derived from the record. But to start from the beginning, Newman was the developer who developed Lake Delton, who got the permission from the state to dam Del Creek and make Lake Delton. Newman, the dam at some point was transferred, the ownership of the dam, which is to the north, I believe, of this property, was transferred to the ducks. The ducks used an easement to access the lake and drive their ducks around. It was thought by Soma, and I think by the ducks, that the ducks also owned this 25-foot strip. Have I answered your question? I'm sorry. The relationship of the ducks to this strip derives from the fact that they owned the property to the north. And it was thought that they had acquired this 25-foot strip. In fact, they hadn't.
This 25-foot strip, does that only apply to the Wilcox's property and perhaps immediately adjacent property?
At one point in time, there was a 25-foot strip in more than the Wilcox property. And the appellate record will show various transfers by the Hines estate to buyers by quitclaim deed of portions of that 25-foot strip. So at one point, the 25-foot strip was more than just what was in front of the Wilcox property.
Well, didn't he Hines keep it, the 25 strip all around the lake at one point?
I honestly can't answer that. I believe so, or at least a substantial portion of it, but I'm not sure that the record will support that.
And the record, you mentioned when Justice Prosser asked his first question, you started by saying, I have to be careful about what's in the record, what's not. There's an allusion in the record to your law firm owning adjacent real estate or parcels of the real estate. Is there anything in the record that you can tell us that would more fully explicate your firm's interest in this?
I will respectfully say, Your Honor, that there is nothing in the trial record, and by that I mean the transcript and the exhibits, that has any relation to that supports the statement that our law firm, which, by the way, it doesn't, is the owner of the Lake Delton holding company.
LLC.
I'll be candid with you, Your Honor, and tell you that.
I'm sorry, what was that?
There is nothing in the record that would say that my law firm owns Lake Delton Holding Company.
What did you say about being candid with the court?
I will be candid with the court and tell you that if you looked in the public records, my predecessor law firm, Boardman, Sir, Curry & Field, is the owner of Lake Delton Holding Company. But that is not in the trial record, and I don't think it is appropriate to say it in the briefs or present it to this court.
Well, what relevance does that have with the Wilcox's claim anyway?
Number one, I don't think it does have relevance. And number two, respectfully, that relevance argument was presented to the circuit court, which sustained the objection on relevance to Lake Delton Holding Company. My focus on this case has been Soma's and what Soma's told Wilcox's when they sold them the property, and how that demonstrates that the Somas were not occupying under claim of title.
Sure.
That's my focus in the case.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals discussed this case and emphasized subjective intent and basically said that the subjective intent of the Somas was not important, didn't make any difference here. What's your response to that?
My response is that the Court of Appeals did not properly analyze this court's subjective intent line of cases. The subjective intent line of cases come in classically. Northwoods Development is an excellent example. Classically, there's a fence line. It's not in the right place. Someone occupies up to the fence line. An adverse possession lawsuit starts, and counsel wants to say, well, you didn't intend to take somebody else's property away. You didn't intend to occupy. If you had known that the fence line was in the wrong place, you wouldn't be making this claim. And this court, Northwoods Development, says that's not material. That doesn't matter. Hostility is presumed. That's what Northwoods Development says. This, to me, is different. This isn't subjective intent of the Somas. This is Somas telling the Wilcoxes, this 25-foot strip, we don't own it, we're not selling it to you. That's not subjective intent. That's an objective manifestation, evidence that the circuit court can look at to say Somas were not occupying under claim of title. So I don't think the analysis of subjective intent is correct. I would point to two things. Northwoods Development itself has a discussion about when it is appropriate to consider the intent of the occupier, of the person claiming adverse possession. It's on page 395 and 396. So this court has said you do at times look at intent. This court in Burkhart against Smith also said you do consider evidence other than intent. You do consider evidence other than use, I should say. That's the Court of Appeals says use is the be-all and the end-all. Nothing else matters. I think that's wrong. Burkhart against Smith says it's wrong. In that case, it was an argument about who is paying taxes. Didn't say it was irrelevant. It said it was a factor to be considered, but is not determinative. We've never said it was determinative. We say it's a factor to be considered. It's evidence. It's probative.
Did the Somas or the Wilcoxes ever do anything to the strip in front of their property that was improper?
Improper? No, I don't believe so. You mean outside of a zoning ordinance or contrary to environmentally bad?
Did they ever do anything that upset the owners?
No.
Why do the owners want to keep this property?
The current owner, again, I'm stepping out of the record here, and let's see, my yellow light is on.
You may respond. That means you've got 5 minutes on your argument and you got 5 minutes on rebuttal, counsel.
The current owners may derive some economic value to this. They may end up giving it to the village if the village wants it. It may matter to the current owners and what they can do to change some rights. Change some rights. This right of access is a point of dispute with the Wilcoxes at the moment. But we're stepping outside of the record, but I will be perfectly candid. The purpose of acquiring this property is to get rid of a right of access and get rid of a title defect.
Title defect on whose property?
It's really on the Wilcox property, but what it is the owners of the 25-foot strip having a right to cross onto the Wilcox property. The current owners intend to abandon that right. That's why we want it.
That's an issue for a different day. I've had a lot of those at the circuit court. They take a long time, and people fight hard over access rights. But that's not today's issue, right?
That is not today's issue. It's not in the record. I think it is an appropriate question for a court to ask, what are you doing here? fighting over a 25-foot
strip. What's the deed say? Whose property is this right now, according to the legally filed document?
Let me refer again to the record.
That'd be good.
I offered to prove that Lake Delton, I offered the deeds in evidence. They were objected to as irrelevant by the Wilcoxes. That was sustained. So that is not evidence yet. The evidence is that the Hines and Newman estates are the record title holders. And that evidence is the allegations of the complaint, which were admitted by the answer.
Counsel, at some point there was a patio area constructed near this property, and the appendices have some very, very nice colored pictures of the area. There appears to me to have been done, some substantial landscaping done, rocks set out, red rock of some kind. I don't know if I saw a fire pit or not, but is that patio area in the 25-foot strip?
In part it is, yes.
How long is, does the record indicate how long the patio area has been there?
It was put in by the Wilcoxes, according to their testimony, so it would have had to have been after 2002.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Wait, I'm sorry.
You foreshadowed that the title owners are going to try to strip the easement rights?
No. Let me be clear. This was a bilateral easement that the Somas had the right to cross the 25-foot strip to get to the lake. That right belongs to the Wilcoxes and cannot be taken away from them by anybody other than a government with just compensation. There is a return easement by the owner of the 25-foot strip to cross onto the Wilcox property to maintain a core wall. That is what I'm foreshadowing we want to get rid of.
But that's not here before us today. And what, if anything, does that have to do with this adverse possession claim?
In my mind, nothing. Respectfully, I don't think it does. But the
court
wants
to know. Well, it makes the property valuable.
Yes.
Yes. And that's the point.
It makes us want to own the property so
that's
we can
right.
do something with it.
That's right. So the question is, you haven't done anything with it for X number of years. That's the other side.
Yes.
You haven't done anything for X number of years. Now you have a reason to want to claim this property because it does have a value to the record owners, right?
That's correct.
Now, my question is, are the deeds an issue here, the old deeds, do they make clear that this 25-foot strip is in the chain of title of Newman and Hines and Titus, or whatever else you talked about?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
If I went to the records before this all started, I would find that the record title holder was Z.
Yes.
Not Wilcox, right?
Yes.
Right.
And in fact, you would go to two places. First, the record title holders for the 25-foot strip, and that is all laid out very carefully by Mr. Corcoran in the complaint. I see my red light is on. I'll just finish.
You can complete your answer to my question.
Yes, thank you. But also the Wilcoxes bought by a certified survey map that clearly states that the 25-foot strip is accepted.
Is accepted, not theirs, right?
It's not included in what is being conveyed to them.
Right.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Edward A. Corcoran, representing the Wilcoxes.
Thank you, Your Honor, members of the court. We have a different view of the law than the petitioner. We believe that the subjective intent of the occupier or the true owner hasn't been relevant in Wisconsin for over 100 years.
So would you please pull that microphone up a little bit? Thank you.
Is that better?
I'll find out.
You're still hard for me to hear.
Okay, I'll try to speak louder.
The acoustics in this room are not terrific, so...
As I started to indicate, we have a different view of the case than the petitioner. We believe this case is really about the petitioner asking the court to change the law on subjective intent that has indicated that subjective intent of the occupier or the true owner has not been relevant in Wisconsin for over 100 years. This court noted in the case of Ovig versus Morrison in 1910 that the sole test for adverse possession, the only test, is the physical character of the possession. And The court noted that that was how the statute was written and addressed the wisdom of the legislature in developing that single test.
But doesn't that just slightly miss countering the argument from your opposing counsel, which is to say his response to that, which he made earlier and in his briefs, is those kind of statements are indicia of the hostile nature of the possession or the possession under claim of title, much like this court has looked and circuit courts routinely look to see who paid the taxes. Now, that's not a determinative factor, but it's an indicia of whether the person who's occupying it and claiming successful adverse possession occupied it in a manner under claim of title, hostile to anybody else.
But we have a different view of that, Your Honor.
I know you do, but they have to be reconciled.
Obviously, we do. We're of the opinion that the law provides that the sole test is the physical character of the possession.
If that's the case, then the people, you know, I live in an area where people may, for years and years and years, stay on lake property. They even build docks, and they make fireplaces, and they do all sorts of really great things, flower beds, and they treat that as if it's their own home. And it may be 20 years that someone stays in a property. That becomes theirs?
Yes, it would.
Really? I think a lot of lake owners and people who own property would find that surprising.
Well, that's been the law. You have to look at why we have adverse possession as a part of the statute. And it's to deal with abandoned property. Well, we have a situation
this property was abandoned. So it must be abandoned and then physically occupied by someone else.
Really
two parts?
If I could explain how the adverse possession statute works. We're really dealing with property generally that's been abandoned. In this particular situation, the developer of the lake, Hines and Newman, set up these 25-foot strips and abandoned interest in these 25-foot strips. They never maintained, developed, improved those strips. They never did.
What about all the people up north who don't go up north very often and, you know, they have a lot of property up there. They don't scour every inch of their property. If someone else sets up on their property, it's deemed abandoned I guess I look at adverse possession as an exception, something that is a little more difficult in the law to prove because basically you're taking someone's property without compensation. So that, to me, is a big hurdle to overcome. It isn't just having a dock or some flower pots or building a fire pit. It's got to be more than that. So, yeah, help me with this. I don't think it can be the sole test of physical character of possession. If that were the case, then a lot of people lose their property today.
A person would only lose their property if, and this words of this court, after the flag of hostility is raised by the use of the property, by the development, maintenance, and improvement of the property, after a period of 20 years, we're not talking about somebody doing this over a weekend or the summer or it's over a period of 20 years where someone has abandoned the interest in that property. And then at that point in time, the statute, we're not only talking about necessarily Section 893.25, we're also talking about 893.32, which says that the titled owner cannot come in and cannot re-enter or attempt to eject the occupier after that 20-year period has passed. The adverse possession laws exist in all the states of the United States.
I know that. I've got that. I just think it's a high burden, a big hurdle to overcome. It isn't something that is easy to do, and that's why I'm coming back to tell me the legal standard as to why you win and why the trial court was wrong.
Well, one of the things with adverse possession, why I'm saying that it, there shouldn't really necessarily be a problem with it, and that's what the legislature has recognized, is this property has been abandoned for this period. The true owner, the titled owner, hasn't had anything to do with the property. Somebody else has been maintaining, developing, improving that property for that period of time. And the legislature decided that after 20 years, the titled owner cannot come back in. The titled owner cannot re-enter, cannot try to eject, because they have abandoned their interest. That's the law in Wisconsin. That's the law in most other states. And that gets to the question that Ovig versus Morrison addressed 100 years ago, and that is that the physical characteristics of possession, that's the sole test. That's what they determined the legislature had set up as the sole test. So once that's occurred, after 20 years, the titled owner doesn't have a right to come back in. Some states, there's different laws in different states as to how that could be addressed, or whether or not even the titled owner could be compensated. Colorado passed a law in 2011 modifying their adverse possession law, saying that in some instances maybe it would be appropriate to compensate the titled owner for the titled owner's loss. But that's not the law in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, it's just the sole test as the physical characteristics of the possession, and that law hasn't changed with the Burkhardt case or any other case that this court has decided or the Court of Appeals has decided in Wisconsin.
Counsel, only if you're finished. Are you finished answering the question of Justice Ziegler? I don't want to interrupt. Are you finished?
Yes, I am.
Okay, now I will ask a question then. Thank you. A couple of times you made reference to the statute and the test here in Wisconsin, the sole test here in Wisconsin, but I want to take a look at the test as set forth by the legislature in 893.25 sub 2A. And specifically, I want to focus, and do you have that statute, or I assume you're familiar with it?
Cause I do.
That's what we're here about. And in 2A, it says, only if the person possessing it in connection with his or her predecessor in interest, now I get to what I'm interested in, is an actual continued occupation under claim of title. As I understand the facts, the Somas never claimed title.
Somas never claimed title, but that's really a legal nullity. If you look a little further down in 893.25 into the Judicial Council Committee notes, they talk about as to the modification of this law in 1979. The word interest has been substituted for title under the previous 893.10 because it more accurately expresses the nature of an adverse possessor's rights until the 20-year period is run. There is no requirement of good faith entry under this section. I think what that's trying to tell us and what claim of title means is in no case under 893.25 will the plaintiff, the occupier, be able to say they claim title. When in the pleadings in this case, and I would probably submit in the pleadings in any other case brought under 893.25, those pleadings will indicate that the titled owner is Mr. Newman and Mr. Hines, who've been dead for many, many years, or whoever that titled owner might be, and that the occupier, who has had an interest in this property, is now claiming title. So the fact that the Somas didn't say to someone that they had title, they did not have title.
Okay, let me continue with the statute then. The next words, or the following phrases, exclusive of any other right. Again, I refer to the Somas, and didn't they acknowledge the right of someone else, perhaps mistakenly?
Well, to the extent the entry by the Ducks to do some work in 1982 was to the exclusion of the Somas' rights, there's no evidence in the record that after 1982 of anyone else having anything to do with the property but for the Somas and the Wilcoxes.
Do you read into the statute exclusive of any other exercise of right, or is it exclusive of any other right? And what, if any, is the import of emphasizing the exercise of the right?
Well, I think that the exercise of any other right would be a right that has been exercised to develop or occupy the property. The sole test that the court has recognized as being important in an adverse possession case.
Let me maybe refine my question. It seemed to me by your response that there has been no action by the Ducks since 1982, suggests to me that they have not they didn't exercise any perceived right. But do you think that 2A requires the exercise of a perceived right, or can it be just the acknowledgement of the right of others, or understanding of the right?
I understand your question. I believe it requires the exercise of a right rather than the acknowledgement of a right. An acknowledgement, the rights of occupation, or the acts of occupation to improve, maintain, and develop the property are the acts that are apparent to the public and thus apparent to the true owner, or should be apparent to the true owner. And the true owner then has a period of time in which to act, or the true owner loses those particular rights.
Let me go with a little broader concern and have you respond to it, broader than the specific language of the statute we have before us. And in looking at the facts here, I see that Somas, publicly denied ownership. They said to the tax folks, this isn't our property, don't tax us. They specifically told the Wilcoxes at the time of sale that they were not purchasing ownership to the property in question. So despite that public statement that we don't own it, and at the time of transfer in 2002, you're not going to own it either, it seems a head-scratcher that now the Wilcoxes would be declared legal owners. So can you help me? That's a broader question. That's more of a, I can't quite, it doesn't make sense question. Help me with that, if you would.
Well, as I tried to argue earlier, the idea of claiming title for the Somas or the Wilcoxes, even for the Wilcoxes today, although they have asserted a claim of title in this lawsuit, before the lawsuit, they never asserted a claim of title. The title is still in the estate of the dead individuals. For the Somas, they did not have title. How could they claim to the Wilcoxes that they were transferring title? If they had a piece of paper and they had a good faith belief in title, then that would have been a transfer, and we'd be operating under 893.26 that talks about a transfer of an interest with a good faith claim of title. The Wilcoxes, although they might have said something to someone, making a statement to a third party, the only cases that are out there that talk about making statements to third parties say that's not irrelevant. Why? That's not relevant. Why would a statement to a third party be relevant? Adverse possession is between the occupier and the titled owner.
And it is irrelevant in your analysis that they took possession in 2002, that is the Wilcoxes, with the clear statement of the predecessor owner that this is not included in the transfer.
Well, I'm going to go back to the statements of this court that say that the sole test for adverse possession is the physical characteristics of the possession, not what the Somas might have thought. It didn't matter what the Somas had thought, whether or not they thought they were the owner, whether or not they didn't think they were the owners, whether or not they were planning to and scheming to somehow acquire ownership of this property. That didn't matter. They did not have title. They did not have title to transfer.
Where is all right here?
If we accept your view, do we have to withdraw language from any cases? I'm going to ask that same question to Mr. Bartston.
No, I don't believe we have to change.
You think that the view you espouse and the view espoused by the Court of Appeals is consistent with the case law? Now, the Court of Appeals says it's consistent with the Keller case.
Yes.
The Court of Appeals says it's consistent with Alley v. Russo, 1979, with Milkey v. Dodge, 1908, with Stoic Living Trust, 325 was second. That's a more recent case, commenting that although some of the circuit court's findings suggested the true owner's subjective intent was relevant, the circuit court correctly recognizes that elsewhere that the subjective intent of neither party is relevant to the claim of adverse possession. Are all those true?
Yes. The only time the subjective intent of the occupier is relevant. If you look at going back to the Burkhardt case, the Burkhardt case essentially says once there's been occupation, the occupier has established that they've occupied and improved that property for a period of 20 years, there's a presumption that ownership transfers under adverse possession. The only thing that can upset that presumption is that there are a couple of things, and one of those things is, did the true owner make an offer to purchase to the titled owner during the 20-year period of occupation, or whether or not that occupation was with the permission of the titled owner? Those are the exceptions. That's when subjective intent can be considered.
Well, the Court of Appeals cites Burkholder and uses this quote. We consider the acts of the defendant in building his cottage, removing the dead trees and brush and putting in a lawn, extended substantially over the disputed property and was sufficient to plant the defendant's, quote, flag of hostility, unquote. They cite a 1910 case which says, quote, actual occupancy of land to the exclusion of the true owner, regardless of whether in good faith or bad faith, whether by mistake of boundaries or the intent to claim the land with full knowledge that the claim is wrongful, satisfies the cause of the statute. Has the statute changed substantially since 1910?
It hasn't changed with respect to this issue, Your Honor. I think another way to...
You think we'd have to withdraw some of that language if we went against you?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
You think we'd have to withdraw some of that language in these cases if we went against you?
I don't think any language needs to be changed in the with regard to these cases.
If we hold for you. But if we say subjective intent is important...
If the court decides that to add the element of subjective intent, then it rules out the law that's been advanced and by this court in all these cases.
Counsel, I don't come close to having read all of these cases. I've read some of these cases. But I note that in footnote 6 of the Court of Appeals opinion, after embracing the position that you are holding, that essentially it is the possession is the sole test, the character of the possession is the sole test, it does drop a footnote to say, in essence, well, I'll say what it says. We do not mean to imply that the many published adverse possession cases uniformly ignore the beliefs of the parties. Now, I haven't read all of these many published adverse possession cases, but I take from that footnote that the Court of Appeals is cognizant that there are cases that, of course, do involve subjective intent. And the Northwoods case comes to mind.
Which case, though?
Isn't it the Northwoods case that has a discussion regarding subjective intent that your opposing counsel referred to and seems to rely upon?
Well, the Northwoods case, yes.
It's paragraph 21 in the Court of Appeals decision.
I think that in answer to Judge Bradley's question, the subject, as I thought I said earlier, the subjective intent of an occupier is important. If the occupier made an offer to purchase to the title owner during the statutory period of occupation, during that 20-year statutory period of occupation, or if the titled owner was occupying by the permission of the titled owner. So in that sense, the subjective intent is important. I think in many of these other cases where they address claim of title or hostility, the conclusion of the court in all of these cases has been, and there hasn't been a different conclusion and a different result that would work the other way in an adverse possession case, they've all concluded that the physical characteristics of the possession trump everything else, and that's what's important. If of course we want to just consider, you know, we're talking about these words of law, but let's talk about how this may work in a practical setting. And we have a real good example of a practical setting, and it's part of the record of this case. And it's the 20 other instances where the estate of Hines, which was a testamentary trust that would existed from 1977 to 2006, that would have been the titled owner of the Hines portion of this reserve strip, when it was given and was asked at 20 different times to transfer this reserve strip parcel from those individuals from the titled owner to those individuals, in each instance, the trust agreed to that transfer. Well, let's look at two different parts of that. By agreeing to that transfer, or even requesting from the trust that they wanted the transfer, would each of those individuals who'd been maintaining and taking care of this abandoned property, would they have destroyed the hostility of their possession by going to the trust and saying, we don't own this parcel, we would like to? Would they now be subject to ejectment? Or the potential re-entry of the titled owner after 20, 30, 40, 50 years of occupation? We think that runs contrary to the adverse possession statute. We also believe that gives a pretty good example. Think about the attorneys for that particular trust, which were, it's a matter of the record, were also the Boardman Law Firm. The attorneys for that particular trust, when presented with that question, they agreed to that transfer to clear title for each of those requests. And they also agreed that the property transferred had no value. Now, think about how that works into the adverse possession question. If that property had some value, would the attorneys for that trust have been transferring that for no consideration? Well, it didn't have any value because the 20-year period of occupation had probably passed with respect to each of those particular parcels, and they were just transferring it to clear title. If they didn't transfer it to clear title, those owners would have been forced to begin an adverse possession action to obtain title. So,
what's the difference between being a squatter and mere possession and adverse possession? Is there any distinction under your theory?
No, adverse possession rights could be considered squatter's rights. To the extent that the party is using property that's not been used or abandoned by the title owner for a period of time, and then in different states, there's different requirements for that, and the title is transferred, and the idea behind it, you know, the policy idea behind it is to improve property and maintain property and use property. It gives the titled owner a long period of time to understand that there's been an occupation and to step in if the true owner thinks it's necessary.
Counsel, can go on.
A squatter would not have claim of title.
A squatter would not have?
No, because there's no title record in a squatter. You just go on the land and say, hey, I'm staying here until I get evicted.
Well, if the person...
I mean, that supports your argument on claim of what the words claim of title mean.
If the party was occupying the land and was improved, maintained the property for a period of 20 years, and I don't know what you if you want to call that person a squatter, they don't have to claim. We believe they don't have to make a physical claim of title.
Right.
That after the 20-year period of time, if they're not ejected,
and that applies no matter what's set between the land, the title holder, and the squatter. It's possession and what you've done on the property, regardless of what these people have said to each other?
It's
your theory, if it holds true, it doesn't matter if I say, you know what, I'm not using that. Go ahead, build a dock, go down there, enjoy. And if I do that for 20 years and the person says, I know, that's your property, I'm not going there. But if they do that long enough, I've given up my property.
Not
right?
Not if it's with the permission. Not if it's with permission.
Oh, then you get into, but then it's not mere possession. If it's permissive, then you have to get into more than mere possession, right? Then you have to take testimony. It becomes subjective. Here's what I thought. Here's what I said. Here's what she said. Here's what they said, regardless of mere possession. So it can't be both ways. I need to know how you reconcile that.
If the possession is with permission, you cannot acquire it.
Of the owner. Permission of the real owner.
Permission from the owner.
That's right.
And there's a number of cases that were cited in the material that indicate that seeking permission from a third party, such as the Ducks that are not the owner,
is
does not destroy hostility. One of the cases that the petitioner wanted to rely on and its request that the law change in Wisconsin, the Cahill case from Rhode Island, they indicated, well, we should rely on the reasoning of the Cahill case. Well, the Cahill case says that the same as the Ovid case, that if there's an offer to purchase, it destroys hostility. But the Cahill case also says that if an offer to purchase is made to the third party, that does not destroy hostility. And that's what we're talking about here, is offers to purchase made by, to the third parties, we don't believe destroy hostility.
Could I just ask a couple of questions? Do you have any dispute that the Wilcoxes have easements on the strip?
They have an easement to cross the strip by foot traffic to access the lake. They do not have an easement to improve the reserve strip, to mow, to put patios in, to riprap, to put in a sprinkler system, to put in a retaining wall, take out the retaining wall that was there, put in a new one. They have no title to do that. That title would still rest with the title owner. And so the work they did for improving was beyond their right to just cross to access the lake.
But if, let's say I own the strip, and I have granted an easement, and I see the people who have the easement really improving the property, am I going to complain about that?
Well, if you would be the owner of that strip, and you granted an easement for foot traffic, and they decided to improve that strip, put in patios, gazebos, put in stone steps to the lake, vegetate, take down trees, put in new trees, put flower beds in. When they started doing that, they would be raising that flag of hostility. And you have then 20 years to either eject them or try to re-enter the property.
Or you could send them a letter every January 1 saying, thank you for improving my property. I'm paying additional taxes on it, but it's really worth it. It looks great. It improves your property. It improves mine. Keep up the good work. You have my permission to do that. And he does it for 20 years.
If they were making the improvements with permission.
That's what I just gave them permission. Every year I give them permission.
You could probably say a little
less than
that.
Which goes to show that I'm the property owner. I've exercised dominion and control. Right? And told them that. So it's pretty hard for them to come in and say it's been open and notorious. I know it. And I'm giving them permission to do that. Right? I can do that if I'm the property owner, the 25-foot strip. Isn't that the point?
If the occupation and use is with permission, it's permissive.
Okay.
Counsel, I've got two questions, and I've waited just because they're not directly on point, and I apologize to my colleagues and everyone, but they've been on my mind since I started reading this case. The first is there anything in the record to indicate how people got the impression that it was the Wisconsin Ducks that was the true owner?
There is something in that record regarding the Wisconsin Ducks, and that had in 1982. It's included in the materials from the Baraboo National Bank, the trust for the Hines. And there's a letter from the village clerk Kay McAsee in 1982 to the trust saying, we'd like you to execute this easement. We need to put a sewer in. It turns out that the trust, own this property. Everyone thought the Ducks used to own the property. And so there is in the record that at that point in time, probably the Ducks were then informed that they didn't own it. And maybe they but the Ducks no longer owned it. Kay McAsee owned it. At that point in time, there's also, I think it's page 82 of the trial transcript, Soma was asked to execute an easement too. And Soma said, well, I thought I owned the property. I don't know why I had to execute an easement. And so the Ducks were, to the extent the Ducks were in the picture, and we believe it was a very limited picture they were in, they were out after 1982, and
okay.
That's in the record.
And the second question I have, Mr. Newman. Now, he built and developed the lake and the real estate, real property around the lake. And I can see why it would have been important for someone doing that to reserve a right up to 25 feet, because if I'm the builder of a lake, I want to control how far the water goes. Is there a lake association now that controls the dam, the water level, or is it the DNR? Who does it now?
The dam is now owned by the village of Lake Delton.
Is that all in the record?
If it's in the record, yeah.
Yeah, it's not in the record.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, thank you.
Justice Prosser had a question that was not completed.
I'm sorry, I just am really interested in what's actually going on here. Do the Wilcoxes just want more property, or are they concerned about what the Lake Delton Holdings people are going to try to do to the property they have?
Yes, they are concerned. I have a disagreement with the representations Mr. Bartson made as to what might happen if Lake Delton Holding Company gets control of this particular property. And he contends that it has to do with a right of access from this reserve strip to the Wilcox's property to make dam repairs. The Wilcox property is adjacent to the Lake Delton Dam and has part of the earthen dam on its property, including a concrete core wall. There's an easement from the Wilcoxes to the owner of the dam that allows for access onto their property to improve, maintain, and replace the core wall of that dam. That's the subject of other litigation between the Wilcoxes and First American Title Company, which is represented by Mr. Bartson in that particular case. We contend that the argument they've made in that case that somehow if they have control of the reserve strip, they're going to be able to force the village to abandon the easement that's going to allows it for access, and so that decreases their damages. We believe Lake Delton Holding Company wants to somehow get control of this property to force some influence on the Wilcoxes in this other litigation, and that's why we think it's so important to look at the fact that this property was abandoned by the true owners many years ago. It was improved and developed. Whenever this question came up for other owners, the property was just transferred to those owners. Why? Because the period to eject them had gone. The property was valueless. It only has a value now for the purposes of extorting some influence in another piece of litigation.
Well, we're knee-deep into this other litigation now, not in the record.
Right.
But as a matter of public record, has litigation been filed in that case?
In the other case, yes.
And is it in Dane County, or is it what county is it in?
It's in Sauk County.
In Sauk County. And so if I went to Sauk County, I could find that litigation.
We've referenced three parts of that case that have gone to the Court of Appeals already in the record.
Okay. And has it been completed in Sauk County yet?
No.
All the pleadings done? All discovery done? I want to know where it is. And should this case be held for the other case?
In theory, we're going to trial in April of 2014.
That's a good theory. That means you may or may not go there, right? You may not have trial. Okay. Does the decision in this case affect the other case? I don't mean practically. I mean legally.
Legally, no. Okay. Practically, maybe.
Okay, I understand that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bartson, if we hold your way, what kind of language do we have to withdraw from the other cases, especially the cases that are cited?
The language
of appeals.
Several come to mind, Your Honor. First of all, Burkhart. If it's true that use alone is the be-all and end-all, then Burkhart is wrong.
Paragraph 18 in the Court of Appeals. Okay.
Pardon me?
That's paragraph 18 in the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
Might have to withdraw language there.
Right. Just okay. To make the point, this Court said in Burkhart, the proposition is that it's use alone, and I don't agree with that. Burkhart, okay. The Court said, payment of taxes is probative. Not determinative, but probative.
Right.
North Woods. There was the discussion that I cited earlier, where this
North
Court explained.
North Woods is cited in paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals. Okay.
Yes.
Chief, is your question, what language would we have to withdraw from cases that say that the nature of possession is the sole test? Is that what your question is?
I don't think that's what those cases say. My question is, the Court of Appeals, as is required by law, has to follow the case law of this state as set forth by the Supreme Court and as set forth in other Court of Appeals cases.
and they appear on the face of the Court of Appeals decision to do that and pick out language and rely on it. Now, it's
which
possible,
they can't do.
Which they can pick out language and rely on it if they do it accurately and not take it out of context. And so my question is, I'm assuming that they're relying accurately on language, and there could be a debate on whether the language, what language means in context. But if we're going to hold your way, we have to, quote, clean up our prior cases if they appear to go in another direction, or the Court of Appeals cases if they appear to go in another direction.
Yes.
So I'm asking you, what cases cited by the Court of Appeals appear to go to favor the Court of Appeals or are used by the Court of Appeals that we have to do something about?
Ovid.
Pardon me?
Ovid. If you're going my way.
Ovid. Right. Yes. That's cited in paragraph 18.
I misunderstood. Ovid. Ovid, to the extent that Ovid says that use is the be-all and end-all, this Court has said otherwise elsewhere, as has the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
What other cases?
Yeah.
What about
Alley?
Alley, yeah.
Or Mielke, or Stoic.
Right, and I'm...
Stone Bank.
Right. You know, if you look at Stoic, or Stroik, what it says is, and that's what I really wanted to address... This Court has to address, then, what does claim of title mean? It can't be a nullity. It's in the statute. Statutes aren't nullities. It can't be a nullity, so what does it mean? And what this Court has said is hostility means that the possessor claims exclusive right to the land. That's the Otto against Cornell case. I think that what, if Your Honor is asking, what do we need to clarify? It's what does claim of title mean? And what does exclusive of any other right mean? Because to me, it is impossible. I don't understand how one can say, I told the Wilcoxes, I don't own this property, I'm not selling it to you, yet they are back to say, yes, but you occupied under claim of title. How? That's what I think you would need to have to address. So is it use alone, or is there other evidence? The way out of this thicket is to return to Burkhart, which is hostility is a presumption. In the rare case, there may be evidence to overcome the presumption, but this is such a case.
You know, to say return to Burkhart, well, I can't argue that with you because I'd have to look at Burkhart. But to say return to Burkhart and say hostility is a presumption doesn't get us anywhere unless we define hostility.
Right.
So, you want us to define hostility how?
I want to quote the case that I turned the corner on, meaning hostility doesn't mean bad acting or animus or anything like that. It means the intent to claim exclusive possession to the land. So, if Soma testifies, I don't claim exclusive possession to the land, which he did, does that negate, is that evidence that would then...
What about the no trespassing sign?
The no trespassing sign, I believe the evidence shows, was put up by the Ducks.
Well, maybe they ought to have been named a party.
Maybe we have a lot of adverse possessions.
Yeah.
Right.
The no trespassing sign, yes.
It wasn't taken down by the... Wilcoxes.
And again, red light is on, so I will do my best to answer the question. The testimony clearly was that the Somas kicked people off of this 25-foot strip. People used it to cross in front of the lake. Fishermen used it. No question. They kicked people off. I did ask Mrs. Soma, if Titus came on, would you kick him off? And she said no. So she was recognizing the right of others to come onto it. He was in the chain of title.
Hey, I can kick some people off my property and not others. That's
sure.
Part of my rights.
Right. But why? I mean...
I don't even have to have a reason.
Yeah, that's true.
Even a good reason.
I don't dispute it. It's your property. You do it with as you wish.
With exceptions.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel. I have thought about adverse possession since I was in law school a long time ago, but it's always fun to return to first-year rules of law, which seemed in a more complicated legal system simple now until we have to deal with a particular case. Then it's not so simple. But we appreciate counsel's briefs and oral argument on adverse possession. And that now end our hearing on 12 AP 1869, Richard S. Wilcox versus the estate of Ralph Hines et al. We'll take a few minutes break and then a return for our second and last case. And I see that, that the American Title Company is involved in that, too.